We have two speakers this evening. After the 10-minute speaker is finished, we will have a 10-minute break for coffee and fellowship, followed by our featured speaker, and I will now be the 10-minute speaker. My name is Dakota, and I'm still an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 21st, 2011. I come from a world that's absolutely indescribable in 10 minutes, so you guys get the short version. Nightmare on North St. Clair Street in Painesville, Ohio, pretty much sums it up. And I learned from a really young age that chemicals could change how I felt. And that was what I wanted to do more than anything in the world, because how I felt was horrible. And nothing that I ever did was enough, and I wasn't enough. And so I changed how I felt. Beer was my first drug and probably my first love, because it changed how I felt and it made me not feel, as long as I stayed drunk. I was probably a full-blown alcoholic by the age of 7. I understand that that's probably really hard for a lot of people to understand, but it's my story and I'm sticking to it. I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous the first time when I was 13 years old. And you told me to keep coming back. And at that time in my life, nobody wanted me around unless they were hurting me. So it was very different for me to hear people tell me to keep coming back. Of course, in my very alcoholic brain at that time, I figured you wanted something from me. But I kept coming back. I didn't get sober, but I kept coming back. And I believe that that foundation carried me through the next 30 years. I ended up homeless from the age of 14 to 18. At the age of 18, I married a very abusive man, and I had 3 sons with him. The abuse continued. The drinking continued. The changing how I felt continued. The not wanting to live continued. When I was 42 years old, my middle son admitted to me that he was a heroin addict, and I took him off to rehab. And at rehab, they said that we had to go to Al-Anon or Nar-Anon for family members of alcoholics and addicts. So I went to Al-Anon, and I had a foundation in Al-Anon because my dad was an alcoholic. I come from a long line of alcoholics. And my mother was in Al-Anon when I was growing up, so I was very familiar with the 12-step process. I had never worked the steps myself. I continued going to meetings for a long time, even when I was a teenager and homeless, but I never got sober and I never worked the steps. So I went to Al-Anon, and I started working the steps. And I was only doing it because the rehab wanted me to do it. But I learned 2 things. The first thing that I learned is that it is impossible to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and not change, even if you're still drinking, because I was. The second thing that I learned was that it was impossible to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, change, and continue drinking. And so a year and a half after I started in Al-Anon, I myself got sober. It took me several years to understand that I didn't get sober because I was ready to get sober, because I wanted to get sober, because God himself came down from the clouds and said, it's time to be sober. I got sober because I wanted to show my son that he could do it, because he wasn't being able to stay clean. He was in rehab twice. He was in the mental hospital twice. He was in and out. He loved recovery. When he was clean, he absolutely loved recovery. He would go into high schools and talk about his addiction and share that with the kids. He believed that if anybody had come into his high school and told him that heroin would take over his life, he might not have ever done heroin. So he loved recovery, but he just couldn't stick around. And I don't know. It's not my job to take his inventory. I don't know if he just wasn't working the steps or if he just wasn't having the necessary spiritual experience. I don't know. But he couldn't stay sober. And so I got sober to show him that he could. And I jumped right into the steps. I had to exchange glances with your featured speaker because he's my sponsor. And I thought that I never did any writing around the first step until I was working with somebody later on, and they asked me, you know, about writing around the first step, and I said, I never did any writing. And my sponsor, I went to him and I said, I didn't do any writing around the first step, did I? And he said, open your book to chapter 3. And I opened my book to chapter 3 and a piece of paper fell out. I didn't even remember writing it. But he had me rewrite that paragraph in chapter 3. Here are some of the methods we have tried. And that was what showed me that I was powerless. Because I came in here with a lot of knowledge, a lot of head knowledge. Like, I knew the steps. I just didn't know how to work them. And so the only way that he could figure out to get me out of my head and into my heart was to have me rewrite that paragraph in chapter 3. To have me really look at my alcoholism in the context of all the methods that I tried to drink like a normal person. We moved right into steps 2 and 3. I did not surrender. I did not. If you're struggling with surrender today and you think that you can't stay sober unless you fully surrender, I'm here to tell you, you can. Just keep working. Because God's going to work on you if you keep doing the work. And so I went through the motions of surrendering in step 3. We went right into my 4th step. At 47 days sober, I finished writing my 4th step. At 48 days sober, my son came home from a conference that he was at. The International Conference of Young People in Alcoholics Anonymous in San Francisco. He had been there all weekend, surrounded by 4,000 young people in recovery from around the world. The next day, he left my house, and he didn't come back because he died of a heroin overdose. And I was 49 days sober when he died, and I'm still sober. And I don't say that because I want you to look at me and see how great I am, because it's not about me. It's about those steps and those traditions up there on the wall. And it's about my God that's way bigger than anything else. I was 2 years sober. It was the night before my second AA birthday when I actually finally got on my knees and surrendered to my God. And now I'm 5 years sober, and I have just recently developed a yearning for a deeper relationship with my higher power that I choose to call God. And so that's why I can tell you, you can continue in the steps, and please do, even if you don't feel like you can surrender to God. Because God will work on you. Because God has worked on me. I have no idea what I'm doing here in Porterville tonight. Except God. I mean, honestly. I've gone through very, very difficult periods in my sobriety. I think we all do. But certainly losing my son barely a month and a half sober was absolutely devastating. I think the only thing that kept me sober right then in that period of time was knowing that if I relapsed, I was going to die because I wanted to be with my son. And looking at my wife and my other sons, I knew I couldn't do that to them. I couldn't have them lose me too. So I just kept doing the deal. And so when I tell people that I work with or people that ask me for my opinion, just keep doing the deal. It's not placating them. It's not just patting them on the head and saying, just keep doing it's real. If you just put one foot in front of the other and keep doing the deal, you can keep doing this thing until you really want to do this thing. And that's where I'm at today. Today I'm yearning to have a deeper relationship with my higher power, and I'm doing the things that I need to do that. I'm taking the next indicated step. And so I've learned that if somebody asks me to be of service, if I can be of service, I should do that. And that's why I'm here in Porterville tonight. And I'd like to thank your featured speaker for allowing me for this opportunity to be of service to you. Because it's all selfish in the end. We're all alcoholics and we're all selfish, and it keeps me sober another day. And if you hear anything tonight from me or from Billy that helps you stay sober another day, then all the better. So, I guess that's all I got. That's not quite 10 minutes, but that's good enough. So, I'm announcing the break now.
Okay, thank you.
10 minutes. So now I'd like to introduce the featured speaker, Billy W. from Fresno.
She got jokes already. I'm Billy, I'm an alcoholic. Sobriety date is June 28th, 1996. And it amazes the hell out of me. It wasn't my first sobriety date. My first sobriety date was somewhere around the middle of August of 1984. And then after that, it was about October of 1984, and then December of 1984, and I had a lot of bouts of quitting. And it was really difficult because what would happen if, whenever I'd quit drinking, I'd get excited, man. This life is going to be great. Everything is going to be finally. I'm finally going to get the PG&E. I'm not going to have to worry about paying the PG&E, and I'm not going to have to worry about getting evicted. And I'm going to keep a job. On and on and on. And about 2.5-3 months into that thing, people were doing stupid things around me. They would park close to me. They would drive by too slow. There was just all kinds of stuff. He'd catch me out there in the parking lot chasing people around with a baseball bat because they parked too damn close to me, and I'm just fighting and I'm screaming, and I got the police at my house and somewhere like that. And people would tell me, "Dude, what is wrong with you?" "I don't know. I'm just pissed off, man." "Here, have a drink." Hand me a beer. I'm going to tell you, that beer worked. As soon as they got up and they started heading to the kitchen to get that beer, as soon as they did that, I started calming down. And I'd get that in my hand and I'd open it up and I'd take another drink and life got great again. And that happened for me over and over and over from 1984 to 1996. In the meantime, I picked up a felony, somehow or another that fell off, and I didn't have to even go to court for it. They said they're going to drop charges. It was a really bad felony. My wife is arguing with me, and she's telling me how bad I'm too drunk, and I'm sitting in the middle of the bed, and she said, "Just leave me alone. I'm all right," So she wouldn't leave me alone. So I did the natural thing. I threw my fruit pie across the room, and she got up and she ran out the door. And I'm like, I've thrown shit as long as we've been together. I've thrown the coffee table. I've thrown dishes. I've thrown all kinds of things. And she's never gotten up and ran before. Well, when I threw that thing, I hit her in the mouth. And she's bleeding. And sure enough, the police come and take me away because, so I call it assault with a fruit pie. And I do that because not to make the joke of hitting her, but to remind me what alcohol will do. It will take something so it's just minimal thing, and it just turns it into a huge ordeal in our life. I enjoyed drinking. I hear a lot of people around the meetings, they say, "Oh, I never had any fun while I was out there. I didn't, everything was so bad." And I don't know who in the hell you were hanging out with, but I had a blast. I could be sitting in Fresno at 10 o'clock at night, and I could be sitting in Las Vegas at 6 o'clock in the morning and have no clue how the hell I got there. And I'm guessing I had a good time getting there. I didn't have a good time getting home. I didn't have a good time explaining how I when I got home, "Where have you been?" "I woke up with a mirage." "Where, how the hell did you get there? What were you doing?" And all those explanations. And I had a really bad memory. I had a terrible memory when I was drinking. I'd forget what time it is. I'd forget that I was married. I'd forget that, there was just all the things that one should remember that's really, really important. Got to go to work tomorrow. I forget that. And consequently, over 16 years, I had 42 jobs. I had several. And when I got here, I had to get a couple divorces. Because I didn't divorce the first one before I married the second one. And come to find out, that works out okay because you're not legally married to the second one anyway, so you don't have to divorce that one. But it can create some legal hassles. And I got through that. My first wife, we had three beautiful kids together. And I'm going to tell you, I love kids, and some of you have seen me around kids, and you know how I just, they gravitate toward me, and I gravitate toward them, and we just have a good time. And I left my wife for a drink and a blonde with a 5-month-old child at home. And I have no idea how I would do that because me today, I could never do that. But I'll tell you, that drink and that blonde, that's all gone. we're going to go have some fun. And we got into the drinking and running around and drugging and more of that fun. Had a lot of fun. Had an $80,000 child support bill when I walked in the doors. You know, because I'm not paying her. She's not doing what I want her to do with my kids. I wasn't going to raise them. I wasn't going to be there with them, but I was pissed off because she wasn't doing what I was supposed to be doing. I had, the list goes on. Growing up, I really wasn't, I didn't have a bad childhood. I didn't have, the intentional, somebody coming in, screaming and throwing things around and so forth like that. I was raised by my mom. My dad disappeared because my grandfather would chase him around with an axe. And he decided that he wanted to leave before I was born. And so I was told all the while I was growing up by my mom and by my grandparents that my dad died in the Korean War and that he was nowhere around. So I was raised by them. Now, my grandfather and my grandmother were really good mathematicians. And just an example of how I grew up, we'd be at the grocery store. And let's say the bill was $15.89. That breaks up pretty good. $7.94, $7.95. Wait a minute. Somebody's got to cough up that extra penny. And it wasn't going to be her. And he would not do it again. And I'm 5 or 6 years old, and my grandmother and my mom are arguing, and grandmother and grandfather arguing in line. And I'm just sitting there. And I'd go back and, that's the little boy that his grandpa was the one that stole the butter last week. Where's your grandpa? He's in the car. Constable will go to arrest him for stealing butter. He'd take $10 to the store, but he'd steal as much as he could. He was really good. He passed that down to me. I was able to take that as a tool that I used for many years. And I did pretty well myself. I did better than he did. I never got caught for it. And I thought that that was a great thing. I really did. I was taught how to lie expressionless. To this day, I can tell you a story and there is no way you're going to be able to tell if it's true or not. And those are the people that are close to me. It's just something that I was taught from a very young age. I was taught that my mother was a bitch and my grandmother was a bitch. I was taught that I didn't have to do what they wanted me to do. And that's how I was raised. And as soon as I got sober and we sat down into some therapy and so forth like that, I immediately went from loving my grandmother, my grandfather, and my mom. I went from loving them to hating them. Because it's like, this is a sick relationship. This is a sick, sick family. And here I am at 36 years old with nothing to show for it. I didn't understand that school was important. I didn't understand that integrity and ethics and morals were important. I didn't understand that it was not a good thing to leave someone at home and go out and have a little fun with her and come back. Because that was just the way life was. Because my mom was doing it. I'd go to school, I'd get my ass kicked because my mom created an argument at home. So all of a sudden it turned into I hated these people that I loved. And so as I got into this thing, I walked in the door. I walked in the door absolutely unwillingly. Absolutely unwillingly. We were out, as we were driving by the Veterans Auditorium there in Tulare, I think that's where my last drink was. It was either there or Hanford. It's a little fuzzy. And so we were driving by, and I'm thinking about it, and I had a great time. I mean, I was drinking, and I was playing beer ball, and I'm doing all kinds of stuff, and we're just wrestling and all this stuff, and drinking until 4 in the morning, and go to bed, and get up at 7, and so we get all packed up, and we get home, and unpack it, and it's like, who pissed all over my clothes? Well, my wife remembered that. She told me that I did. And I was wearing them. There were several other things that happened through that weekend that I didn't remember. She remembered very well. And she decided that that was it. She was leaving. And she said, man, what am I going to do? Well, I know what the problem is, because I was having some health problems, because by then I was always about 145, 150 pounds. And by the time that we had this little altercation now, I was down to 129 pounds. I was in and out of the doctor's office. I was having bathroom issues that I just couldn't understand and explain. And every time the doctor asked me, well, how much are you drinking? I don't know. I'd buy a 12-pack on Friday and buy another 12-pack the next Friday. Didn't tell me about Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. And I didn't buy the Chivas. Somebody else bought that. I didn't buy the bourbon or any of that. So I didn't have to cop to that. I was pretty wound up in that. I can remember going over to the DMV to take my Class B driver's test. Did you know that if you walk in the DMV drunk, they will not let you take a written test? I tried to explain to them, I'm not driving. They still wouldn't let me take the test. So, consequently, I didn't have a Class B license, so I had to make sure that I got past the scales early enough in the morning. I calculated. I have no idea why I never did any jail time. I have no idea why I didn't do any prison time. There's absolutely no reason that I shouldn't have. So, we get home after that little event. She says she's leaving, and I said, I know what the problem is. I'll quit drinking right now. And I did. That weekend was the last weekend that I drank. And so within about 2 or 3 days, I'm really starting to have a hard time. I'm having a real hard time. And here we go once again. Now, I can't get up and down the stairs. And so I'm staying on the couch. But now I've finally gotten rolled up into a fetal position. I still can't get all the way to the bathroom. I'm having all kinds of issues. I can't figure out what's going on with me. And all of a sudden, one morning I wake up and everything is just a weird perspective, and it looked like a bubble around me, and I couldn't remember phone numbers, and I couldn't remember I couldn't remember the number on my house. I'd walk outside. Okay, 510, 510, 510. You know, and I'd go in, I'd have a cup of coffee. I don't remember my address. And I had a week of that. I couldn't remember. You know, and I'm one of these, I'm a memory guy. I can remember my license plates and this and that and all that. Just I can't remember if I'm married when I'm going out. I can't remember to go to work, but I can remember numbers. And so I'm really having a hard time while I'm sobering up. And that was right about April 9th, 10th, 11th, right in there. So that's why, you know, it's kind of cool to be able to speak tonight. So finally, I was like, I got to go to the hospital. I got to go to mental health. And up until that point, my exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous is two drunks sitting on top of a park bench looking across the street. And I asked him, what's all those people doing up there? Oh, that's AA. That's where all the people went that got caught. All those dumb bastards. So, I go up there and I have no idea. When she asked me how much I drank, I was trying to remember because there's Dave Simmons, but he was downstairs. She asked me how much I drank. I says, going through about a half a bottle a day, plus a 12-pack. And on the weekends, then I drink a little more. All right. Here, you're going to have to go downstairs tomorrow afternoon at 5:30. Go see Dave Simmons down on the second floor. I said, what for? He says, that's our alcohol and drug program. I said, oh, no. I don't have an alcohol problem. I haven't drank in 2 weeks. I'm good. She says, well, if you want our help, you need to go down there. All I wanted was, I knew there was enough little pills because I'd experimented. I knew what some of these pills did, but I wanted them to give them to me because I was clean now. So they said the only way they're going to give them to me is if I went and did this. So 5:30, I show up and I walk in. You know, I'm pretty good with the women. I walk in to that first meeting and this young lady is facilitating. I says, I'll be able to graduate this program, no problem. I sit down over there, and, you know, I'm handsome as hell. I'm 129 pounds. My clothes are kind of hanging on me. My hair is, I probably hadn't showered in 4 or 5 days because the shower was upstairs, and it was, you know, I was having trouble navigating all of that stuff and so forth. And so they go through and they say, well, this group's grown too big. We're going to split the group up. Starting tomorrow night, you're going to be with somebody else. You know, the list will be on the door. And I go home and I'm like, I hope it's her. I hope it's her. I can win her. And I walk in and this guy, his name is Nick Dash. And, you know, after doing some research, this guy is kind of renowned throughout the state. He's a drug and alcohol specialist. And I was pretty special with him. I knew a lot about him, too. So I figured we'd probably get along pretty good. And we didn't get along good at all, I got to tell you. He kicked me out of his office more than once. I walked in there. When it came time to graduate, it's a 90-day program. It came down to about day 70, and I went in there, and we have to we write this first step thing. And I go in there, and I'm reading it off. And they started laughing. They said, well, that's bullshit. And I'm thinking, that's not bullshit, because I took it right out of the back of the book. There's stories in here. They wanted to know about alcoholism, so I did a book report for them. I went home, and it was really kind of nice because that woman that wanted to get rid of me and I wanted to keep her, she actually had some compassion because I was crying when I came home because of how badly they treated me. And make a long story short, 6 months after I started that 90-day program, I finally graduated out of there. And I got through it 1 year after care. It took me 2 years to finish that. And I'm kicked in and out of this group, and I'm, you know, they're telling me how full of shit I am. They're telling me this and that, and I'm like, oh my God. They told me to get a sponsor. I said, what do I look for in a sponsor? I said, it doesn't matter. Just don't get a woman. I said, Suzanne will make a great sponsor. So sure enough, Suzanne made a great sponsor. She was great because she was kind of sick in her own right, and she reminded me of my soon-to-be ex. So I was kind of getting it. It worked out real good. Her husband knew that she wasn't going to do anything. And so I didn't know that. So we actually got through the 95% of my fourth step with her. And I got to tell you, I went through step one. Yep, I'm powerless. Yep, my life is screwed up. Yep, okay, it's going to restore me to sanity if you say so. Yeah, there's a God that I don't understand. Okay, I'm good with that. Searching and fearless, I don't know what that means. I don't even know what a resentment was. Didn't have any resentments. That bitch, those bastards. Can't believe those damn people. No resentments. Finally got them down on paper. Sat down and I did my 95% fifth step with her. And I went home. The book says to promptly go home and find your shortcomings. In short, it's not exactly what it says. It's what it says to do. So I did. I had a lot of things to do. I was very important. I had gotten my kids and so forth like that. And so when I get home, I'm supposed to finish up, get home, take them to a play, do all of this stuff. Oh, yeah, I got to do my sixth step first. I got to do it promptly when I get home. So I go home and I sit down and I go through and I get this list of things that are my shortcomings. And what it is, that's the manual. That's the only manual that I had. You know, if I wasn't greedy, I couldn't go and get everything that I needed for my family. And if I wasn't lustful, I couldn't have the fun that I had. And the list goes on and on and on. Those shortcomings were my assets, man. That was how I survived. That was how I got everything that I owned. That was how I was able to not work. You can't have good family values and good values about yourself if you're going to have 42 jobs in 16 years and survive without those shortcomings. And I had that all reasoned out. It's like, man, there's no way. And I'm supposed to ask God to remove these? What am I going to do? That's a pretty good reason to go through step three a little better than what I did. So as I got down, and I finally, it was like 2 o'clock in the morning, I'd missed the plays with the kids, and I'd missed all this stuff, and I just told the kids, sorry, I'm busy. And they were used to being ignored by me, because if I wasn't drinking or if I whatever, you know. And, you know, going to meetings is a great way to get out of doing dishes and family time. I did that for years. You know, I used this program for everything except for recovery for a long time. And so I finally said, all right. I don't know how this is going to work out, but all right, you can have my shortcomings. That's not really humbly. It's not very humbly, but I said, all right, you can have them. Because it was time to go to sleep. I made a list of the people that I had to make amends to. My mom was right on the top of that list. My grandfather was on the top of that list. My grandmother was in that list. And I had this one other guy. He tried to molest me when I was in fifth, sixth, seventh grade, somewhere in there. And he tried to molest me, and I had to put him, because I got him back. And, you know, I created all kinds of problems for this guy. So, needless to say, he needed to be on my amends list also. So I said, all right, yeah, I'll put these people on. I don't have to worry about that one. I said, Grandpa is dead. I don't have to worry about him. Mom, I'll go out there eventually. And this guy, I'm never going to see him again. All right, next day I'm on my way through town. Sure enough, I stop at the red light, going across the jail. There he is. Now, I'd been around long enough at that time to know that if God puts somebody in your path, it's for a purpose. And I didn't understand that step two and God putting somebody in your path has a correlation at that point. But we stopped and we talked. And he made amends to me, I made amends to him, and we're buddies today. Yeah. It's amazing what we're doing in other people's lives for them to get better. And it's because of the experiences that we had. Went out, made amends to my mom, and I was pretty thorough on that. Went out and laid down on top of my grandfather's grave, made amends there. Made a living amends to my grandmother. I'm still making a living amends to my grandmother because she was one of the people that kept us as close to sane as possible. And that was how I ended up getting up to step 10, you know, and that was how I got into a way of life that I have it today. I took about 3 years to get through 9 steps, and in that 3 years, there was nothing spiritual about it whatsoever. It was an action. It was a job from the neck up. It was a way of getting through things. It was a way of, okay, I'll do the program. All right, shut up. Get off my back. All right. And in the meantime, she moved out. Life was a little more comfortable. And I am not doing well. Once again, I'm just depressed and life sucks. I can't believe this shit. What am I getting sober for? Why in the hell am I doing this? What is going on here? And I got to tell you, I have gone in and out of those stages through the years. I'm coming up on 16 years at the same job right now, which just amazes the hell out of me. It amazes the hell out of me that I'm coming up to 17 years with Sherry, with my wife. If I plan on making it to 18, I better make sure that's close. But it amazes me that I'm coming up and I've gone to bed with the same woman, woke up with the same woman, and I've never had the inclination. Never even had the inclination to do anything other than that. It amazes me that I get up and go to work every day. It amazes me that I pay the bills fairly well. But what doesn't surprise me is, since I never had a job and I never made money and I make as much money as I do, that I could get credit and I could get this and I could get that. I could buy a house. I could do all that stuff. I could get a foreclosure. I could get a bankruptcy because I didn't learn how to handle money. And I listened to a CD yesterday, and it really put it in perspective for me. You know, this guy says, you know, we sit in the rooms, and we get together, and we look across the room, and they, you know, we get a group of guys over here that kind of womanize, and they kind of hang out with women, and they want to date everybody in the program and so forth. So those half a dozen guys will be over there, and they'll start talking, and so we're like that, and they'll talk about the steps and the traditions, but they never talk about womanizing. Got another group of guys over here, guys and gals, and their thing is gambling, you know, so, you know, they go and get a deck of cards and some chips and put some money on the table, and they're gambling and they're playing cards, and they're talking about the steps and the traditions, and they're not talking about their problem in their life. And that list just goes around, you know, we all kind of congregate with each other. And that's what I did. I found the people that had the same sickness as I did, the same life problems, and I hung out with them. Because if you had financial problems and I had financial problems and we were all making money and everything was okay, I was in the middle of the herd. So I had to be all right. We're all talking steps and traditions. We're all talking about how good everything is. And the light just came on. And it's been about a 6-month progression, and I, you know, I'm 20 years sober, and I'm coming up on, you know, another birthday and all of this jazz, and the light just came on within the last year. The most important thing in this program is not step one. Step one will not keep us sober. If we don't have tradition one, we can't admit we are powerless over alcohol. We can't admit that our lives have become unmanageable without tradition one. If we don't mingle this stuff together, we can't do it. If we can't look at step two and look at it, can you believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity? I want to say that real slow. Came to believe. Now, a belief is a thought process that has an emotional impact. I watched the newcomer walk in the door, and the newcomer's tore up. And the newcomer sits down with somebody, with an old-timer that understands this program and starts going through the program. And I'm standing across the room, and I go, wow, the newcomer's doing better. Now, I'm really appreciating this. Now I've got a thought process with an emotional impact to it that says, I now have a belief that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. That means next time I walk in that door, I'm going to walk in there going, what's in there for me? What's in this room for me? What are you going to say that is going to help me, help God restore me to sanity? See, what I did is I kept it and I made sure that there was no such thing as sanity in my life. So what are you going to restore me to? Ha, 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 ha. And I blew it off. I blew it off. Made a decision to turn our will in our life. Made a decision to do a thorough fourth step. Made a decision to turn our will in our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. We have an understanding of Him by how we watch the newcomer develop. And the newcomer's getting it. So yeah, I have an understanding of how this works. And because of step 1, 2, and 3 and tradition 1, I can get through a death of a child. I can get through losing my house. I can get through a bankruptcy. I can get through a divorce. I can get through anything that happens to me. Life can be in full session because of what I watch God do in these rooms. Now, I can't see God do this in this room if I run in at 5 minutes after the meeting ends or starts and I'm out as soon as we let hands drop. We got to hang out. We got to have coffee. We got to go smoke cigarettes together. We got to mix it up a little bit. You know, I do a lot of service. I do a lot of service. I have this this picture, and I don't know. Somebody planted this picture of this stool. It's a three-legged stool. You see, we work constantly. We say we're working our program. What the hell does that mean? Hey, leave me alone. I'm working my program. We're working our program. We can take our program because of the three legacies. It's recovery, unity, and service. And that's the three legs on that stool. Can we take our stool and set it down in front of us and have that stool sit evenly? When we walk into a meeting, what are we here for? What am I here for? I can tell you what I'm here for. I'm here for what God has for me next. Today I wake up, and every now and then I say a prayer as soon as I wake up. Usually it's on the way down the stairs saying, okay, God, let's do this. What do you want me to do today? And that's my deal. When I walk into a meeting, you know, what am I here for? I don't know what I'm here for. God's going to tell me what I'm here for. I don't know if recovery happens here or if unity happens here. Because I tell you, you can sit in a lot of meetings and there's only a little blip in there that we want to take home with us. Some meetings, I don't want to take anything home from it. So maybe that's just the unity. I don't know how that works out for yourself. Service. I'm going to tell you, when I first got here, my idea of going to a meeting was, let's see, I'm going to look at the schedule here. That one's in walking distance. So off I go. I walk to the meeting. I walk into that meeting, that first meeting. I open the door. Plume of smoke comes out. It's like, yeah, this must be like the bomb shelter. I love the bomb shelter there in Fresno. And go in there, and that place stunk worse than anywhere I drank. I mean, it was absolutely atrocious. That was probably the only thing that impacted me at that point, because I was pretty numb to everything else. Well, we were just talking just before the meeting. I have plans of going to a meeting. I want to go to a big meeting in Baltimore in 2018. I want to go to a big meeting in Detroit in 2020. I literally have, the miles. You know, the only miles that I get are from flying around for this program. You know, I have the opportunity of being in service. And at first it was about having a title. You know, I had to be DCM, or I had to be this, or I had to be that, or whatever. And I'll tell you what, you don't need to be any of that stuff to be in service. All you got to do is raise your hand when somebody says, I need somebody to be on a committee. You know, we've got people that, friends of mine, that are on the PI committee in New York. They're just a member that sits in the room. But it came across there. It was on the bulletin board. She sent it in there. She put her resume in there, and voila, she's a member. She just became the PI on the PI committee. You know, we got others that are the same thing on the literature committee. You know, and those committees are all over. You know, a lot of techie people. You know, we've got a lot of things that are coming up that are available to be a committee member on. And that is just the most amazing thing, to sit down with another alcoholic and just get down and work and get some things happening and stuff like that. 2003, I was introduced to PRASA, Pacific Region Alcoholics Anonymous Service Assembly. The way I was introduced to that was on my way to a speaker meeting out in Kalinga. The driver said, hey, how would you like to be alternate DCM? I don't know what they do. Don't worry, it'll be easy. No big deal. Okay, I'll do it. All right, so she shut up. I didn't have to listen to her anymore. She called me on Monday and she says, hey, you didn't show up to the meeting yesterday. Oh, I know, I forgot about it. Oh, that's okay. I vouched for you. I told them that you were going to do a good job, and so we went ahead and nominated you, and we elected you. I'm like, you know, if I don't show up, I probably don't want to do it. So I don't show up for the next 3 months. She calls me up and she says, hey, they voted that if you don't show up next month, they're going to kick you off of the steering committee. Oh, now that's bullshit. You can't kick me off. There's no way. You are not. From that point on, I had hit something like 410 business meetings from that point on consecutively, and it was just bizarre. Just tell me you're going to kick me out. You're going to lock the door and not let me in. I'm going to be there, damn it. Well, the DCM, district committee member, couldn't make it to PRASA. He said, I'm not going to be able to make it. You're going to have to go. I'm like, I don't even know what it is. I don't want to go. I got in the van and I get up there. I see all these people in suits and ties. I see all these people in nice dresses. I see all these people in their native attire. I see people. At that particular process, it was a pretty good size when there was about 1,500 people there. And for the next 3 days, I listened to the passion of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was, and the guy that was running New York at the time, Greg Muth, the guy that was running the General Service Office, he just came and sat down with me and, hey, how you doing? You know, and we're just talking. And he was just a nice, kind guy. And that list of people just goes on and on and on. You know, the people that are in leadership positions, they know what that means. They means that if they're at the highest level of service, that means that they're the ones cleaning out the toilets. They're doing the heaviest, hardest work. And it broke me. It broke my heart in such a wonderful, passionate manner that I was able to see the love that goes into making certain that the doors are open for the newcomer. And we want to know how the newcomer found out that we're here. And we want to know, how long did it take you? What could we have done to have made your, you know, allowed your misery to be less? And these people spend their life doing this. I was in L.A. at a process sometime after that. And the speaker was talking about on Thursday he had gone to the doctor. And the doctor told him that he had 6 months to live. There's nothing we can do. He was the main featured speaker on Saturday night. He was a featured speaker because he was there. He was telling us that somebody else was going to have to take his place. And that he would have 6 months to help anybody that wanted to do that part, that level of service. And these people are the ones that make this thing available for us. I got the opportunity as a member sitting in the chair just like you guys. I got the opportunity to be one of the hosts on the host committee of PRASA in Sacramento this last March. And it was just absolutely amazing to be able to walk through and make sure that somebody could get to the next meeting and do the things that they needed to do to take the love and service and kindness of Alcoholics Anonymous back to their home groups. And they absolutely love it. I want to tell you, if you're not in service, there's something in there that just reaches in and stabilizes the recovery and the unity that comes from it. And that's why that three-legged stool has to sit evenly. So, anyway, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just been my pleasure to be here tonight. It's a fantastic program. My life has changed immensely. I've gone through sponsors that have died. The one that died, it really just freaked me out because I said, all right, I'll do my other 5% of my fifth step. I said that I'd done my 95% fifth step with Suzanne. And one day he says, have you finished your fifth step? And I says, yeah. He says, bullshit. Have you finished your fifth step? You wouldn't be where you are right now if you finished your fifth step. I said, well, yeah, there is a little something in there. There's some dirty laundry. Come on. Sunday afternoon, and I'd vowed that I'd do it with a dying man. Sunday afternoon, 4 o'clock, I finished my fifth step. Monday morning at 10 o'clock, he died over the wheel of his rig. And I don't know how that happens. Because I don't know if I would have been able to have, I don't know how safe I would be if I knew that there were people around that knew everything about me. Because there's still some things, you know, there's things about me that I absolutely hate. Absolutely hate. I can't believe that I did that. But I know that I'm forgiven, and I know I'm forgiven by the most important one of this program, and that's me. Because if I can't forgive me, I'm not going to stay sober. Thank you. God bless you.